What happened in the War of the Ring? That war raging in the background of the main story of The Lord of the Rings. We know about some of the battles, Helm's Deep and the Siege of Minas Tirith, for example, but there is a lot more to explore, and we'll break it down here in nerdy detail. Hi everyone, this is Robert. Welcome to In Deep Geek. On this channel, we dive deep into the worlds of The Lord of the Rings, A Song of Ice and Fire, The Witcher, and much more. Welcome. This is a compilation of 9 separate videos I did on the subject of The War of the Ring, stitched together into one huge video for your convenience. I hope you enjoy it. What was Sauron's master plan? How did he plan to win the War of the Ring? And what were his first steps? Let's start with the simple fact that this is a war that Sauron wants. In every war there is an aggressor, the side that first invades the other or fires the first shot. And in this case, it is Sauron. Of course it is. He wants to rule all of Middle-earth. Over the years and millennia, Sauron had tried to subjugate Middle-earth several times, most recently with the War of the Last Alliance of Elves and Men, at the end of the Second Age. At the end of that, the One Ring was cut from Sauron's finger and subsequently lost, and Sauron himself was vanquished, but not gone for good. The elves and humans kept a long, watchful vigil for his return. Gondor built a series of defences and watchtowers around Mordor, just in case. And 1,000 years into the age, Gandalf was dispatched by the Valar along with the other Istari to help support, encourage and guide this effort. And eventually, Gandalf did manage to track down Sauron. He had been hiding in southern Mirkwood in the stronghold of Dol Guldur under the disguise of the Necromancer. He had been regathering his strength there for centuries. There's a bit of history here about Gandalf's growing suspicions and previous expeditions to Dol Guldur, but the decisive moment was in the year 2941 of the Third Age, when Gandalf finally persuaded the White Council to join him to attack Dol Guldur. That's what Gandalf was doing when he went missing in The Hobbit. Sauron is forced to flee to Mordor, and formally re-announces himself to the world a few years later. Gandalf had long suspected war was coming, but this was what finally drew Sauron into the open. Actually, Gandalf had been concerned that whenever the war came, he knew war was inevitable with Sauron around, Sauron would try to leverage Smaug's presence in the Lonely Mountain. He thought, probably rightly, that the elves of northern Mirkwood, Lothlorien, and maybe even Rivendell would be exposed to possible dragonfire attack if Smaug wasn't dealt with, hence Gandalf's support for the quest for Erebor. And although the events that unfolded in that story are too far removed from the War of the Ring to be counted as part of that war, they did undoubtedly impact heavily on the geopolitical situation in northwest Middle-earth. The elves were freed from the threat of Smaug, the goblin and orc kingdoms around the Misty Mountains were weakened, Erebor became a dwarf stronghold once more, and Dale was repopulated as well, leading to a strong alliance between dwarves and men, all of which proved important in that later war. Of course, the most important thing that happened in 2941, during the quest for Erebor, was the One Ring passing into the hands of Bilbo Baggins. Gandalf had his suspicions about it at the time, but no one truly understood then the significance of what had happened, and were focused on other things anyway. We'll come on to the ring again in a second because it's clearly important, but let's focus now on the more conventional war preparations. Because both sides spent the next few decades slowly preparing for war. This was always going to be another war of two massive blocks facing against each other. Saruman's forces were a bit of a wild card later on, but overall we are looking at the nations of the east and south of Middle-earth, Mordor, Dûn, Harad and so on, against Gondor and their allies Rohan, the last remnants of the once mighty elven kingdoms, and the dwarves with their human allies. It is 77 years from Bilbo's adventures in The Hobbit to the start proper of The Lord of the Rings when Gandalf tells Frodo what his ring actually is. And Sauron uses that time to amass his forces and defences, starting with calling the 9 ringwraiths back to him in Mordor. They hadn't been quiet all the time before then, incidentally. The Witch King in particular had spent a very long time destroying and undermining Arnor and Gondor, the kingdoms descended from the Numenoreans, Sauron's old enemies. The world would have looked very different but for that. Sauron taking this time to build his army means that it was huge by the start of the war. As well as his own orcs, there were trolls, half-trolls from Far Harad, wargs, men from Harad, easterlings from Rûn, naval support from the corsairs of Umbar. Basically, most of the east and south of the map of Middle-earth that we know swore fealty to Sauron. and he also built up his support structures for the war. We get a brief glimpse of this when Sam and Frodo make it into Mordor in the book. The camera sort of zooms out and Tolkien tells us a little of what is there. Neither he, Sam, nor Frodo knew anything of the great slave-worked fields away south in this wide realm, beyond the fumes of the mountain by the dark, sad waters of Lake Nirnan, nor of the great roads that ran away east and south to tributary lands, from which the soldiers of the Tower brought long wagon trains of goods and booty and fresh slaves. Here in the northward regions were the mines and forges and the musterings of long-planned war. Basically, Sauron had his support infrastructure and logistics sorted out. His army was kitted out with weapons and armour, food grown to feed them, and it all paid for by funds extracted from tributary nations. And the army was massive and growing all the time. Frodo and Sam spy what is effectively an ad hoc city built on the plain of Gorgoroth inside Mordor, where his soldiers gathered and waited for the order to advance. And that Olifaunt that Sam saw outside Mordor, that was part of even more forces rallying to Sauron's call. Tolkien doesn't give us many precise numbers, but at the final Battle of the Morannon, the battle that took place just outside Mordor while Frodo and Sam were actually at Mount Doom, there seemed to have been in excess of 60,000 in the Dark Lord's army. You can add to that the numbers he had committed and lost in the attacks on Osgiliath and Minas Tirith, the force that crossed the Anduin at Cair Andros, his allies the Corsairs of Umber, and the significant forces that attacked various northern targets at the same time. We'll cover all of those things later in the series, but overall it's fair to say that at the start of the War of the Ring, Sauron had well in excess of 100,000 troops at his disposal, plus elite servants like the Nazgûl. Then there were Sauron's alliances. Primary among these, of course, was Saruman, who was amassing his own army of orcs and Dunlendings. It's unlikely that Sauron ever 100% trusted Saruman, but he certainly put in the time to get him on side. The strategy here is pretty straightforward. Saruman was based at Isengard, which guarded the only real way through the massive mountain ranges that split Middle-earth into western and eastern halves. Yes, there are passes through the Misty Mountains, but if you want to march an army through, the Gap of Rohan really is the only overland route for hundreds of miles. Even if Saruman betrayed Sauron, he could still be counted on to keep Rohan occupied, preventing them from supporting Gondor when Sauron attacked them. At least, that was the plan. And Sauron was also trying to undermine Gondor via the Palantiri. He found that he couldn't dominate Denethor's mind as he had wanted to. Denethor really had an astonishingly powerful mind for a human, living up to his Numenorean heritage. But he did manage to repeatedly show Denethor the might of Mordor growing, and make him fearful, defeatist and on the defensive, and we know how that ended. In the short term, though, it meant that whereas Denethor supported limited guerrilla warfare against Sauron's forces led by Faramir's rangers, he never really contemplated anything more offensive, leaving Sauron the space to build his forces in peace. Facing Sauron were the elves, who were severely depleted in numbers, dwarves, who had also fallen from the height of their powers, and humans. Of the two great successor powers to Numenor, Gondor and Arnor, Arnor had been destroyed in a long campaign by the Witch King of Angmar centuries earlier, and Gondor, well, we've just talked about Gondor, they would be formidable opponents still, but if they could be isolated, there was no reason to think that Minas Tirith wouldn't eventually fall. All told, Sauron's army was better prepared, more united, and several times the size of their opponents. We can say with quite a lot of certainty that had this come down to just one army against another, then Sauron would have won. This clear disparity in army sizes played into both sides' strategies for the war. Gandalf, Elrond, Galadriel and co. clearly decided that they couldn't just march on Mordor and expect to win, hence the stealth mission to destroy the ring, a reliance on surprise attacks and pinch points at places like the Hornburg and the Pelennor Fields, and high-risk gambles like Aragorn's rallying of the Army of the Dead. Sauron, on the other hand, seems mostly to have relied on brute force, combined with dividing and conquering his enemies. Breaking that down a little bit more, his plan was to focus first with the bulk of his forces on eliminating Gondor as a threat. They were the largest single force opposing him. He would do that with a full frontal assault while preventing their allies from coming to their aid. This latter part of the plan meant simultaneously launching a wide series of smaller attacks along the Gondorian coast against Lothlorien, Northern Mirkwood, Dale and so on, and trying to prevent the famed Riders of Rohan from aiding their Gondorian allies. Sauron didn't mind losing troops in this, he had plenty to spare, and he even kept most of his forces back in reserve right until the very end. Given his overwhelming dominance in conventional forces, it actually seems like a pretty solid plan. As a magical world, we have to acknowledge that there remained the possibility of either side doing things outside of conventional tactics. On the Free People's side, this obviously included Aragorn calling on the dead men of Dunharrow, the Ents marching on Isengard, and so on. But Sauron wasn't without his own bits of magic to fortify his army. We're told that he gave the Witch King added demonic force before the final battles, gave all of the Nazgul fell beasts to ride, and had his forges create magical weapons to aid their fight. We saw one in Grond, the battering ram, which breached Minas Tirith's famed gates with ease, and I have speculated elsewhere that Sauron had been stockpiling Mithril to make more of such magical weapons to target other enemy strongholds. At which point, we should return to the subject of the One Ring. All this talk of amassing armies and planning for a ground invasion of Middle-earth might give the impression that Sauron had overlooked the One Ring or decided that he didn't need it. Nothing could be further from the truth. He was obsessed with it. He knew that with it he would be whole again and immensely more powerful. I'm sure in his own mind he would have been unstoppable. The power of the three elven rings would have been broken, Elrond, Galadriel and Gandalf would have had to take them off, and his darkness would have soon dominated the continent. At least, that's how Elrond seems to have understood the situation at the Council of Elrond. Of course, if someone else got a hold of the ring and used it to launch their own plans to dominate the world, things would be a whole lot harder for Sauron, and that's what Sauron was convinced anyone would try to do if they got the ring. And now he had reason to believe that the ring had been found. When he called evil things to him in Mordor, rallying his troops, Gollum had been drawn there. He was captured, interrogated, and Sauron discovered about Baggins and Shire. He sent an emissary to the dwarves of Erebor in case they knew what and where that was, sent out orc hunting parties, and released Gollum back into the wild, hoping that he would be drawn to it and Sauron could take it from him. Eventually, he even sent out the Nazgul, his most powerful and loyal servants, uncloaked and invisible, to hunt it down. In short, it was obviously in Sauron's best interests to hunt for the ring, but to do so in as low-key a way as possible. He didn't really want the opposition knowing what he knew or what he was up to. How this tied into his war plans was that he knew that he now had to go on the offensive after all that time amassing his armies. He couldn't run the risk that someone else might use the power of the ring to rally their forces against him. Much better to attack now and seize the advantage. Added to which, it would be easier to find the ring in territory he occupied with an enemy defeated. As we noted at the start of this video, he was the aggressor here. His closest and strongest enemy was Gondor, so he'd start there. The rest could wait. Anyway, all of this brings us to the acknowledged first real battle of the War of the Ring, Sauron's attack on Osgiliath on June the 20th, 3018 of the Third Age. To put this into the context of the main story, at this point Gandalf had just told Frodo about the One Ring, but Frodo had yet to leave Bag End. Things were still very calm in the Shire. Anyway, Osgiliath was a strategically important city, and a symbolically important one too. For a long time it was the capital of Gondor, before Minas Tirith. However, at the time of the War of the Ring it was largely abandoned, although a Gondorian garrison was often placed there to protect the main bridge that crossed the wide Anduin River. Osgiliath was attacked by a small army from Mordor, led by the Nazgul. Boromir and Faramir led the resistance for Gondor and ended up pushing the enemy back and destroying the bridge over the Anduin, so a bit of a draw all in all. That initial battle over, Sauron went back to gathering his forces for a while and sent the Nazgul out on the quiet to try to find the ring. Boromir, meanwhile, headed off in search of Rivendell, and Faramir stayed in the area of Ithilien, to the east of the Anduin River, with some rangers doing some guerrilla warfare against any of Sauron's forces who ventured that far out. Frodo and Sam find him there doing just that much later in the story when they pass by that way. Although it might seem like a bit of a damp squib of a start to a war, Sauron's intention at this point seems not so much to kick-start his invasion as just test out Gondor's defences and misdirect his opponents. By attacking with just a fraction of his forces and committing the Nazgul there, he probably bought them a bit of time when he immediately sent them out incognito, or as incognito as they ever could be, to hunt for the ring. Sauron also seems to have concurrently launched a small raid against the elves of northern Mirkwood, freeing Gollum. So this first phase of the war was actually relatively low-key. Just one notable battle and a few skirmishes, and then everyone settled down to a sort of phony war that lasted a few months. Frodo and then the Fellowship made their way eastwards. The Ringwraiths were out searching for the ring until they got washed away outside Rivendell, and everyone was marshalling their forces and defences. But Sauron's plan was in place. He had tested Gondor's defences, sent his top team out to hunt for the ring, put in place plans to keep the elves, dwarves and Rohan out of the war for a time, and would now gather his own forces for a spring offensive against Minas Tirith. The stage was set for the War of the Ring. What was Saruman's master plan for winning the War of the Ring? Did he even have one, or was he just being an opportunist? Let's take a look. Last time, we looked at Sauron's plan. He was the main driving force in the war, sending his troops first against Osgiliath, but Saruman wasn't far behind. Indeed, his forces had engaged in three significant battles before Sauron's forces advanced on Minas Tirith. Most of the first phase of the war was actually at his instigation. How and when Saruman turned evil is something I covered in another video, and I'll look elsewhere at the exact nature of the relationship between Sauron and Saruman, but it suffices for now to know that by the start of the war, he was well and truly corrupted, and although he wasn't exactly free of Sauron's influence, he was still his own person, and had his own plans for the coming war. But his contact with Sauron, as well as his extensive spy network, had given him a key advantage. He knew that the ring was abroad and war was looming, so he could take the initiative. To give Saruman some credit, he does seem to have realised that the war itself was less important than finding and having the ring. Whoever had the ring had a huge advantage. That's why he pursued the high-risk strategy of calling Gandalf to Isengard, if Gandalf wanted to come, to try to discover from him exactly where the ring was. Based on his speech to Gandalf, he seems to have had a prioritised list of objectives that looked something like this. To find the ring and rule himself, or perhaps make a ring of power himself. Failing that, work with Gandalf to rule together with the ring's power, though he would almost certainly have looked to betray Gandalf and rule alone. Or failing all that, if Sauron got the ring, or no one did, work with Sauron to become powerful in his new world, with a view to betraying him in the long run. All of that required him to establish his own power base in the short term and play both sides for as long as possible. However, after Gandalf had escaped from Orthanc and the Nazgul came to visit him to ask where the Shire was, and he denied all knowledge, he will have known that the game was up. Certainly Gandalf, Elrond and co. would view him now as another enemy, and Sauron would soon learn of his deception. So he might as well go on the offensive, keep up the hunt for the ring, and try to solidify his position in the Gap of Rohan. All this had been in his mind for a long time, and he had been spending time preparing, building an army, undermining his neighbouring powers, and building alliances. Merry actually sees this army when he was with Treebeard and the Ents hiding outside Isengard, scouting it out for when they attack later. He tells Aragorn, still later, that all Saruman's people were marching away. I don't know much about this war or about the Horsemen of Rohan, but Saruman seems to have meant to finish off the king and all his men with one final blow. He emptied Isengard. I saw the enemy go, endless lines of marching orcs, and troops of them mounted on great wolves. And there were battalions of men, too. Many of them carried torches, and in the flare I could see their faces. Most of them were ordinary men. Rather tall and dark-haired, and grim but not particularly evil-looking. But there were some others that were horrible. Man-high but with goblin faces, sallow, leering, squint-eyed. Well, of all sorts together, there must have been 10,000 at the very least, said Merry. They took an hour to pass out of the gates. So that's at least 10,000 orcs, Uruk-hai, some on wolfback, men, seemingly Dunlendings, and what appears to be some half-orcs. At the risk of jumping ahead a bit, that force split into two, with some heading to the Fords of Isen, where some will have been lost, and some straight to Helm's Deep, where they were joined by a force of Dunlendings. And Gandalf mentions having to deal with 10,000 orcs at Helm's Deep, so the overall force size here seems to be something over 10,000. Which, if you remember back to last video, is just a fraction of the size of Sauron's army, hence Saruman wanting to stay on Sauron's good side, if he had one. It is, however, roughly of the same scale as Rohan's army, though that is rather more scattered. After Helm's Deep, where they obviously lost a lot of men, Théoden says that he would perhaps have been able to send 10,000 men to help Gondor, but he needed to hold some back, so he only sent 6,000. So Saruman had upwards of 10,000 soldiers, plus those he sent out to hunt for the Ring, like the group that capture Merry and Pippin. And the hunt for the Ring clearly took quite a bit of his own attention. It's often overlooked, but Tolkien mentions that orc band with Merry and Pippin had magical help from Saruman, speeding them on their way. Plus there are all those bird spies for Saruman, scouring the lands. Yes, Saruman knew that if he were to succeed, he needed to find the Ring, but one does wonder whether his attention was so distracted by that he missed some rather obvious threats in front of him, like an army of Ents about to march on his home base, for example. Anyway, Saruman's chances of victory required both finding the Ring and defeating Rohan. Looking back at the map, it's easy to see why. If you ignore treacherous mountain passes and abandoned dwarven mines, the only route between the west and east of Middle-earth for hundreds of miles is the Gap of Rohan, that stretch of land between the bottom of the Misty Mountains and north of the White Mountains. If you control that, you have a huge tactical advantage. He already had the key stronghold nearby, Isengard, and had fostered an alliance with the people on the west of the Gap, the Dunlendings, historical enemies of Rohan, so now his attention must turn to the Rohirrim. Again, this plan had been in the works for some time. His strategy wasn't just about securing a military victory over the Rohirrim, he was seeking to control the land as a whole. Enter Grima Wormtongue, King Théoden's advisor. Saruman tempted him onto his side by offering him Éowyn after the betrayal was complete. Éowyn may have had something to say on the matter, but Grima clearly didn't care. In exchange, he told Saruman all about Rohan's troop movements and so on, kept Théoden sedated and pliable and not particularly proactive, and sought to take out the other two powerful figures in the court, Théodred, Théoden's son and heir, and Éomer, his nephew, by turning the king against each of them. This was how Saruman got away with building that army for so long. Théoden was in no state to rule, and he ignored Théodred and Éomer who were. Still, those two were a problem. The opportunity to get rid of Éomer arose when he heard of an orc troop entering Rohan. Éomer sought permission from the king to ride out and confront it, but Théoden, under Grima's influence, refused. Éomer went anyway. It's good that he did, because those orcs were the ones that had captured Merry and Pippin. Éomer and his men attacked the orc band, killing them, with some losses, and unbeknownst to them, Merry and Pippin escaped into Fangorn amidst the chaos. Éomer returned to Edoras, encountering Aragorn, Gimli and Legolas along the way, and allowed them free passage without the king's permission. So that was twice he had gone against orders, more than enough for Grima to imprison him. Théodred, meanwhile, was concerned by Saruman's preparations and had gathered a force at the fords of the River Isen. He left some of his force on the east bank and took the rest over the river and north towards Isengard, hoping to catch Saruman's army unprepared. It turns out that Théodred had underestimated both the size and preparedness of Saruman's army. After dealing with the vanguard, he found the main force waiting for him and well dug in. Théodred just about managed to beat a hasty retreat back to the fords when he discovered that a fast-moving force of Uruk-hai, wolf riders and Dunlending cavalry had raced down the east bank and were attacking the force he had left there. Faced with a horrible tactical situation, he sent some forces to help out on the east bank, kept some to hold the west bank, and headed to a small island in the middle of the ford to direct the action and support whoever needed it. Théodred's forces on the east bank soon fell, and their vanquishers raced to attack him and his small guard on that island. Théodred was felled, but Grimbald, his lieutenant, rushed to stand over his still just alive body in defiance, at which point The cavalry arrived, quite literally. Elfhelm and a reserve force from Edoras arrived from the east and immediately charged, catching Saruman's army unawares. The east bank was retaken, and Elfhelm pushed on to that island where he arrived just in time to hear Theodred's final words and see his final breath. And at that, with the battle still in the balance, Saruman's forces suddenly and unexpectedly retreated back to Isengard. It seems that Saruman's orders had not been to secure the fords right then, but simply to kill Theodred, then retreat. The king's son was dead, but Rohan retained control of the fords for the time being, and over the next few hours many of those who had been scattered in the battle slowly returned to the fords, surprised to find that Rohan was still in control of them. At which point Erkenbrand, who was at the Hornburg, assumed control of the defence of the Westmark. He moved swiftly into action, dispatching riders to Edoras seeking more troops, which was ignored by Grima, who was now in complete control of Theoden, gathered stores of food and able-bodied men to defend Helm's Deep, and gave command of the forces near the Isen to Grimbold until he could get there. Grimbold therefore dug in on the east bank of the Isen, while Elfhelm, with his reserve force, headed further east. At which point, let's cut back to Saruman, because this was the moment, with the Rohirrim divided and without support from Edoras, that he pushed his forces well and truly onto the offensive. This time he didn't hold anything back. His objective was to take the fords and destroy as many of the defenders as possible, not just a surgical strike to kill their leader like last time. Grimbold's units were pushed back almost straight away to where Elfhelm was, and they combined forces into a shield wall, which held for a while. But as night fell, Grimbold made the decision to fall back even further to the strongest fortress around, the Hornburg. They reinforced Erkenbrand's garrison there and waited for what would become the Battle of Helm's Deep, or the Hornburg if you prefer, which we will look at in the next video in this series. Because that moment really was the apex of Saruman's war effort. The fords of Isen had been taken, Theodred slain, large numbers of the Rohirrim killed or scattered around the Westmark. Support from Edoras would not be coming because Grima held sway there and Éomer was imprisoned. To top it all, one of his orc warbands had found two hobbits a week earlier and were bringing them back to Isengard. Éomer had taken out those orcs, but even if Saruman knew that, he will now have been sure that the ring was nearby in the land he was just about to conquer. If all had carried on as Saruman had planned, he would have control of Rohan and maybe even the ring itself within days. As I said, this was the apex for Saruman, because unbeknownst to him that very day, two crucial events were taking place. Gandalf healed King Theoden, casting Grima Wormtongue out of Edoras and restoring Theoden to his senses. And in Fangorn, the Entmoot was happening, which obviously culminated in the Ents deciding to march on Isengard. Perhaps we can sense some kind of hubris here with Saruman. He had sent all of his army out to war, clearly believing that with the ford secured and the mountains at his back, he was safe in Orthanc. But he clearly hadn't expected the Ents to take up arms against him, or Theoden to break free from Grima's control, or the intervention of Gandalf, Aragorn, Gimli and Legolas. The Battle of Helm's Deep was one of the most decisive in the War of the Ring, but it was very different in the books to what happened in the films. Saruman's plan had started out quite strongly with the two battles of the Fords of Isen. Now we get to the Battle of Helm's Deep, one of the most epic moments in the Lord of the Rings film trilogy, and indeed in cinematic history, a 40-minute long battle scene often considered one of the finest committed to celluloid. While the overall shape of the battle and several of the details are the same in the books, there are a lot of changes to work through. Most will be apparent as we go through the video, but let's quickly address two of them first, starting with the name of the battle itself. We mostly refer to it as the Battle of Helm's Deep, but in the books it is more often referred to as the Battle of the Hornburg. I'll use them interchangeably in this video. To be clear, in case you are wondering, Helm's Deep is technically the valley or gorge in which the battle took place, and the Hornburg is the actual fortress the Rohirrim were defending. Second, the change that probably discombobulated most book fans was the arrival of the elves in the films to fight alongside the Rohirrim. The elves don't appear at all in this battle in the books. In fact, this and the later Battle of the Pelennor Fields are thematically important moments in marking the turning point in Middle-earth history, from elvish primacy to the dominion of man, where humans can now go toe-to-toe with armies of orcs without their elf allies. Yes, Legolas was there, and Gandalf made a significant intervention, as did the Huorns, but you get the point. This is humanity standing firm and showing their mettle. All that said, let's get into the build-up to the battle itself. You'll remember from last time that Saruman had dispatched pretty much his entire army, over 10,000 orcs, half-orcs and Dunlendings, to subdue Rohan. Over two battles at the fords of the River Isen, he had managed to kill Theoden's son Theodred and to claim the strategically important fords themselves. The Rohirrim, who had been defeated there, were scattered, although a significant number, up to perhaps 1,000, stayed under the command of Grimbold and Elfhelm. You may remember them from the last video. To tie this into the wider narrative, by this point Gandalf had freed Theoden from his bondage to Grima and was now darting around Western Rohan at ludicrous speed on Shadowfax trying to rally the defences of the realm. He met these survivors of the two battles of the Fords of Isen, instructed Elfhelm to bury the dead, then head back to fortify Edoras, because Theoden and what remained of the forces there had just left there. Grimbald and his forces he sent to the Hornburg to report to Erkenbrand, the new commander of the Westmark. We'll pick up on them later because they will play an important role in the battle. The newly invigorated Theoden, along with Aragorn, Gimli and Legolas and all the Rohirrim he could spare, were meanwhile heading northwest from Edoras to the Fords of Isen. He just heard that his kingdom was being invaded by Saruman's forces, so it's the obvious direction to head in. However, as you can see from the map, that takes them past Helm's Deep, and they are intercepted en route by reports of the losses at the Fords of Isen. Gandalf counsels a tactical sideways move to Helm's Deep, meaning that Theoden et al. Arrive there before Saruman's forces. Because, yes, Saruman's army was pushing on into Rohan. Now, I suppose they could have pushed on straight to Edoras. It was the capital, and therefore symbolically important, but that would leave them open to an attack from the rear by the forces of Helm's Deep, so they took the pragmatic approach of trying to first take out that fortress before advancing further. So the situation is this. Erkenbrand had assumed control of the West March and dug into the most defendable castle there after hearing about consecutive defeats at the Fords of Isen. He doesn't have long, but he calls the banners, stockpiling food, repairing walls, and establishing defensive protocols. Basically, he does exactly what you would want a commander of a castle soon to be attacked to do, a solid, professional job. He then leaves the garrison there and heads out into the Westfold to gather more forces. Theoden and his cohort, including Aragorn, Gimli, and Legolas, arrive soon after and reinforce the castle, missing Erkenbrand on the way. Contrary to the film, Theoden here was leading a group of soldiers, not the weak and vulnerable of Rohan. That made for good cinema, but in the books this was very much a military force, while everyone else stayed at home. Hence Gandalf sending Elfhelm's cohort back to Edoras to fortify that. If you're trying to keep track of Gandalf's movements during these few days, then just remember that he's on Shadowfax and not really resting much, and therefore moving several times faster than any of these armies. He's working at a frantic pace here. Anyway, at this point we should probably look at some of the geography and history of the Hornburg and Helm's Deep, where the battle will take place. The fortress itself was not built by the Rohirrim, but by the Gondorians, probably nearly 3,000 years earlier, when they still had Numenorean technology. It is a fortress nestled into the mountainside at the opening of a deep valley or gorge known as Helm's Deep, after Helm Hammerhand, a legendary king of Rohan who held out there against the Dunlendings through a long winter. In fact, a lot of the topography of that valley is named after him. For example, one of the valley's defences is Helm's Dyke, an earthen wall across the gorge, and Helm's Gate, you get the idea. The Deeping Wall, a high stone wall, spans the entrance to the gorge, ending with the Hornburg itself, a fearsome fortress. All that protects the deep itself, the gorge which holds the glittering caves, later the wondrous province of Gimli the Dwarf, but mostly used by the Rohirrim as another fallback area. Basically, this is a pinch point, minimising the advantages of a larger attacking force with a series of strong defences the defenders can fall back to in turn if needed. First, the earthworks of Helm's Dyke, then the Deeping Wall, then the Hornburg itself and the glittering caves deeper in the gorge. For those who know it, Tolkien said that his inspiration for the general geography here was the caves at the end of Cheddar Gorge in the southwest of England. Impressive stuff. In terms of numbers, the garrison at the Hornburg seems to have been around 1,000, and Théoden brought another 1,000. Facing them, arriving during the night of March the 3rd, Saruman's army consisted of more than 10,000 Uruk-hai and Dunlendings. They started their attack immediately. They broke through the outer earthworks defence, Helm's Dyke, easily, then proceeded to assault the Hornburg itself, focusing first on the main gate, often a weak point in castles. They brought forth a battering ram, but Aragorn, Éomer, Gimli and some others snuck out via a postern gate and scattered those attackers. Next, they started assaulting the Deeping Wall that ran right across the valley entrance, throwing ladders up, hundreds of them, we're told. But they again were repelled. It was around this point in the battle that Legolas and Gimli made that bet about who can kill the most orcs. Legolas had quite the head start at that point, using his bow to shoot down enemies from afar, whereas only a few had so far come within reach of Gimli's axe. So, at that point, only a few hours into the battle, which had taken place entirely at night time, the defences were holding up pretty well. But then Saruman's forces found a way through. A culvert allowing a stream to pass under the Deeping Wall. They pushed through while Rohan's soldiers were focusing on defending the top of the wall, with Gimli using all his dwarfy engineering skills to rapidly block up the culvert after them. Then there was a temporary pause where Gimli and Legolas could compare their counts. Gimli was now up to 21 with Legolas at 24, but then an explosion from that culvert. We read, "There came a blare of trumpets. Then there was a crash and a flash of flame and smoke. The waters of the Deeping Stream poured out hissing and foaming. They were choked no longer. A gaping hole was blasted in the wall. A host of dark shapes poured in. 'Devilry of Saruman,' cried Aragorn. 'They have crept in the culvert again while we talked, and they have lit the fire of Orthanc beneath our feet. Elendil! Elendil!' he shouted as he leaped down into the breach. But even as he did so, 100 ladders were raised against the battlements. Over the wall and under the wall, the last assault came sweeping like a dark wave upon a hill of sand. The defence was swept away." This was a turning point, because the defenders could no longer hope to hold the wall. Orcs and Dunlendings came rushing through, and the Rohirrim forces were split in two, each part retreating to somewhere more easily defended. Gimli, Éomer, and some others took refuge in the caves in the walls of the gorge, holding out heroically for some time. Aragorn and Legolas joined Théoden in the Hornburg itself. It was a formidable stronghold, and we're told several times that it had never been taken, but Saruman's forces had magical gunpowder, or whatever that had been, that had blasted a hole in the wall, and Théoden had itchy feet. He was the leader of a cavalry culture, not a people who cowered behind walls. At which point, events move very quickly. Théoden decides to go on the offensive when day breaks, get on his horse and charge out of the Hornburg and through the enemy's lines. Aragorn has also been waiting for the dawn, clearly sensing things might change then. We should note that whereas in the films Gandalf is clear that he will return at a certain time with aid, he doesn't in the books, simply saying that he would come, but not saying when. So what Théoden and Aragorn both do next is not based on the knowledge of a relief force arriving imminently, but a knowledge that the castle would probably soon fall, and at best a hope or a feeling that help might come with the light. Théoden went off to prepare himself and his men for a last heroic charge out of the fortress, while Aragorn leans out over the gate and starts chatting with the Uruk-hai outside, warning them that none knows what the new day shall bring him, and that if they didn't depart, they would all die. This seems to be a sort of light precognition by Aragorn, and it's not the only time. He much earlier warned Gandalf about his peril if he entered the mines of Moria. Aragorn is low-key magical throughout this story. The Uruk-hai, of course, laugh at him, and no sooner had he jumped back down than there was a roar and a blast of fire. The archway of the gate above which he had stood a moment before crumbled and crashed in smoke and dust. The barricade was scattered as if by a thunderbolt. It's that magical gunpowder again. The orcs were about to charge through when the great horn, Helm's horn, was sounded, and Théoden and his men charged out of the fortress on horseback, cutting right through the attacking army, all the way through to the other side, where they paused and took stock. By this point, Daylight has well and truly arrived, so they can finally see properly what is going on, and it's something remarkable. The land had changed. Where before the green dale had lain, its grassy slopes lapping the ever-mounting hills, there now a forest loomed. Great trees, bare and silent, stood rank on rank with tangled bough and hoary head. Their twisted roots were buried in the long green grass. Darkness was under them. Between the dyke and the eaves of that nameless wood, only two open furlongs lay. There now cowered the proud hosts of Saruman, in terror of the king and in terror of the trees. They streamed down from Helm's Gate until all above the dyke was empty of them, but below it they were packed like swarming flies. Vainly they crawled and clambered about the walls of the combe, seeking to escape. Where once had been a valley floor, now there was a forest. These are Huons. We're not told exactly what they are, but Merry speculates that they are Ents that have become more tree-like or less sentient in some way, and that sounds about right. They had been in Fangorn Forest, presumably just largely living like trees, but had been roused by Treebeard to take part in the attack on Isengard earlier that day, and he seems to have sent them on to finish off Saruman's forces at Helm's Deep. We don't know all their powers, but there are clearly a lot of them, and the orcs and Dunlendings are rather scared of them, rightly so, as it turns out, because at the same time, this happens. There, suddenly upon a ridge, appeared a rider, clad in white, shining in the rising sun. Over the low hills, the horns were sounding. Behind him, hastening down the long slopes, were 1,000 men on foot. Their swords were in their hands. Amid them strode a man, tall and strong. His shield was red. As he came to the valley's brink, he set to his lips a great black horn and blew a ringing blast. It is Erkenbrand, with the reinforcements he went to get, 1,000 men or more, and Gandalf. This force, and Theoden's, seized the initiative and attacked. The orcs panicked and scattered into the forest, killed by the Huons. Or, as Tolkien rather more poetically puts it, wailing they passed under the waiting shadow of the trees, and from that shadow none ever came again. The Dunlendings just threw down their weapons and surrendered. Theoden's men had seemed just minutes or hours from destruction, but with the help of reinforcements arriving just in the nick of time, it became a famous victory. The Dunlendings were shown clemency by Theoden and allowed to return home, providing they promised to stay on their side of the River Isen from then on. The dead orcs were placed in a mound on the valley floor, and that night the Huons disappeared, presumably back to Fangorn, leaving a new hill where the orc bodies had been, the Death Down. No grass ever grew there again. But most importantly, Rohan had been saved. Gandalf, Theoden and the others set out as soon as they could to first confront Saruman, whose war was now over less than 2 weeks after he'd first sent his army out into the field. Gandalf, with his new authority as Gandalf the White, cast Saruman from his order, breaking his staff, and instructed Treebeard to keep him under house arrest in the Tower of Orthanc. We will come back to Saruman right at the very end of this series, because he does have a role to play in the final battle of this war. The Battle of Helm's Deep was a turning point in the war. For a time it had looked like Saruman might take control of Rohan, but now Rohan was free to come to the aid of its ally Gondor when Sauron launched his attack there. Minas Tirith could have been isolated and alone, but it now had allies who would arrive just in time in the next battle we will look at in this series, the Siege of Gondor and the Battle of the Pelennor Fields. What was Denethor's plan for the War of the Ring? Did he even have one, or did he think it was doomed from the first? Denethor often comes across as completely hopeless in the War of the Ring. He abandoned his post and inspired despair, not hope, when Sauron's forces drew near, not to mention his attitude to Faramir, a massive hindrance to the forces of good. While all that is true, Tolkien is very clear that Denethor is far from a weak leader, or at least he used to be a great leader, before the main story begins. The words he uses to describe him in the appendices are, "Denethor II was a proud man, tall, valiant, and more kingly than any man that had appeared in Gondor for many lives of men. And he was wise also, and far-sighted, and learned in lore. Indeed, he was as like to Thorongil as to one of nearest kin. When Denethor became steward, 2984, he proved a masterful lord, holding the rule of all things in his own hand. He said little, he listened to counsel, and then followed his own mind. So Denethor started out wise and a good ruler. He was masterful and far-sighted, which meant that he was very aware of the shifting geopolitical situation around him. Sauron had announced himself 3 decades earlier. Barad-dûr was being rebuilt, and the forces of evil were amassing on Gondor's doorstep. How might he counter this, the greatest threat any steward of Gondor had yet faced? Because, at the risk of skating very lightly over Middle-earth history, Gondor had been in slow retreat for centuries. Once they had kept watchtowers and castles encircling Mordor, ever vigilant for the returning shadow. But now those positions were abandoned. Osgiliath was largely rubble. Northern and western Gondor ceded to allies or abandoned. Gondor was a shadow of its former self. They had allies in Rohan, but enemies now to the south in Harad and Umbar. The magical technology that built their strongest structures was now long-forgotten lore. Well, the first thing Denethor seems to have done is gather ever more information about what was going on. Strong intelligence is the foundation of every good military strategy. And to get that intelligence, he turned to something the stewards had kept secret for years, the Palantir of Minas Tirith. Though the stewards, we read, deemed that it was a secret kept only by themselves, long ago I, that's Gandalf, guessed that here in the White Tower, one at least of the 7 Seeing Stones was preserved. In the days of his wisdom, Denethor would not presume to use it to challenge Sauron, knowing the limits of his own strength, but his wisdom failed, and I fear that as the peril of his realm grew, he looked in the stone and was deceived. Far too often, I guess, since Boromir departed. He was too great to be subdued to the will of the Dark Power. He saw nonetheless only those things which that power permitted him to see. The knowledge which he obtained was, doubtless, often of service to him, yet the vision of the great might of Mordor that was shown to him fed the despair of his heart until it overthrew his mind. We should pause for a moment to acknowledge the impressive fact that Denethor was strong enough not to be dominated by Sauron through the Palantiri. Sauron was using another Palantir that he had captured from Minas Ithil, in case you were wondering. Denethor also, it would seem, probably gained useful information from Saruman via their link through the Palantiri network. We read this in Unfinished Tales. Whether he thus made contact with the Orthanc Stone and Saruman is not told. Probably he did, and did so with profit to himself. Palantir lore is a whole other subject. I did a video on it if you're interested, but Denethor here was helped by the fact that he was the legitimate user of that stone as the rightful steward of Gondor. It made it easier for him to use his stone, but still Saruman and Sauron are both Maiar, so Denethor's strength of mind is impressive. But the important point for the plot is that despite Denethor's strength of mind, Sauron still had enough control to only show Denethor what Sauron wanted him to see, which was Mordor growing in strength, well beyond anything Gondor could resist. While this is good message management by Sauron, it's also true. Sauron's forces did far outweigh whatever Denethor could put into the field. Which probably explains why he never actively considered going on the offensive against Sauron. His father, Ecthelion II, did a little of that, authorising Thorongil, secretly Aragorn, to lead a mission to scupper the fleet of the Corsairs of Umbar. But Denethor largely kept himself to digging in at Minas Tirith, and near the end sending Faramir to Ithilien, east of the River Anduin, to do a little bit of guerrilla warfare. Faramir was given enough rangers to slow down Sauron's accumulation of forces, but not enough to do any real damage. The plan seems to have originally been to use the River Anduin as a natural first line of defence against the advance of Sauron's army, whenever that came. That's where they made their stand when Sauron launched his first attack, led by the Nazgûl, and they did a pretty good job of it. We're told that Sauron was surprised by the strength of Gondor's resistance. But although Sauron's forces were held back on the east bank of the Anduin, this was done at significant cost, and the decision was made to destroy the last remaining bridge there. A strategic move to slow down Sauron's army when it came in full strength, but also a symbolic one. It was clear Denethor had no intention of moving any significant forces eastwards. From now on, they would be placing their trust, or hope rather, in Minas Tirith's walls. And potentially one other thing. Because it was around that time that Faramir and then Boromir got those dreams of a voice telling them to seek for the sword that was broken. In Imladris it dwells. There shall be counsels taken stronger than Morgul spells. There shall be shown a token that doom is near at hand, for Isildur's bane shall waken, and the halfling forth shall stand. Boromir and Faramir understood little of what it meant, but Denethor surely knew a lot more than he said. As a student of Gondor's history, he will certainly have known what Isildur's bane was and the sword that was broken. Given how highly he rated Boromir compared to Faramir, and how he expected his city to come under attack any day soon, I also think it's telling that he let Boromir, rather than Faramir or anyone else, go on this rather vague quest. What was he hoping? Well, I think the clue is in what he says to Faramir much later, when castigating him for letting Frodo go free. Boromir was loyal to me and no wizard's pupil. He would have remembered his father's need, and would not have squandered what fortune gave. He would have brought me a mighty gift. So Denethor sent who he thought of as his best man to Rivendell, because he thought Boromir would bring him the One Ring. As an aside, this does add another layer to Boromir's fall. It wasn't just him being greedy. He knew his father would want him to get the ring, and he loved his father, and wouldn't want to disappoint him. And it wasn't just for himself, it was for the defence of Minas Tirith, to save lives. Thus do all of the ring's temptations start, with the best of motives. Boromir's failure is real and tragic, but it is also painfully relatable. What Denethor would have used the ring for is another matter completely. Gandalf and Denethor actually have a conversation about that when it becomes clear that the ring is now beyond either of their reach, with Frodo in Mordor. There are two follies to avoid, says Denethor. To use this thing is perilous. At this hour, to send it into the hands of a witless halfling, into the land of the enemy himself, as you have done, and this son of mine, that is madness. And the Lord Denethor, asks Gandalf, what would he have done? Neither. But most surely not for any argument would he have set this thing at a hazard beyond all but a fool's hope, risking our utter ruin if the enemy should recover what he lost. Nay, it should have been kept hidden, hidden, dark and deep, not used, I say, unless at the uttermost end of need, but set beyond his grasp, save by a victory so final that what then befell would not trouble us, being dead. So, if Boromir did bring the ring to Minas Tirith, as Denethor had hoped, Denethor's plan was to hide the ring away and not use it, unless at the uttermost end of need. I suspect, though, that the Witch King breaking down Minas Tirith's gate and orcs pouring in would have counted as the uttermost end of need, so he would have used it in the defence of Minas Tirith. Of course, the ring never made its way to Minas Tirith, so Denethor's last hope was not brought to him. Instead, he was left to do the only practical option he could think of, call in all the aid he could. In practice, this meant sending the Red Arrow to Rohan, and later lighting the beacons. The beacons obviously look cooler, which is why they were used in the films, but they are also a rather obvious call that even Gondor's enemies could see. The Red Arrow could be delivered in secret days before the beacons were lit. And he called the banners, to use the Game of Thrones vernacular. Gondor had lost lots of its lands and people over the centuries, but still, particularly along its southern coast, there lay territories that owed their allegiance to Minas Tirith. The most famous of these is probably Dol Amroth. The problem was that Denethor delayed asking for Rohan's aid until very late, and they had their own local difficulties with Saruman to deal with, so given the distances involved, with the best will in the world, they couldn't be expected to arrive before the battle was joined. And the southern fiefdoms? Well, they did send what support they could spare, but they were also under attack. The corsairs of Umber were raiding along the coast. Pippin sees those forces from the south arrive, and although they were made welcome, the disappointment in their numbers from the people of Minas Tirith is palpable. And that was all, less than 3,000s full told. No more would come. Their cries and the tramp of their feet passed into the city and died away. The onlookers stood silent for a while. Dust hung in the air, for the wind had died and the evening was heavy. Already the closing hour was drawing nigh, and the red sun had gone behind Mindaluin. Shadow came down on the city. It's a depressing moment. To try to be fair to Denethor, he did think a bit more broadly than just sitting inside Minas Tirith and waiting for Sauron's army. He kept the garrison on the island of Caer Andros manned. That would at least slow down any northern crossing of the Anduin by Sauron's forces, and hopefully keep clear the route from Rohan so his allies could get there. And he also made sure that the route from Mordor to Minas Tirith wouldn't be without any opposition, sending a small force out under Faramir to do what it could. "And what of Caer Andros?" said the prince. That's Prince Imrahil of Dol Amroth. "That too must be held if Osgiliath is defended. Let us not forget the danger on our left. The Rohirrim may come, and they may not. But Faramir has told us of great strength drawing ever to the Black Gate. More than one host may issue from it and strike for more than one passage." "Much must be risked in war," said Denethor. "Caer Andros is manned, and no more can be sent so far. But I will not yield the river and the Pelennor unfought, not if there is a captain here who has still the courage to do his lord's will." I said we would try to be fair to Denethor because he was clearly aware of both issues, but the forces he committed to both were inadequate to the task, and him passively aggressively sending Faramir out was surely loaded with more than just military planning. In truth, he had largely given up hope by this point. Not entirely, that was to come only when the battle was joined, but enough that the land's defences were just that, defences. He could see no clear path to victory. It was just a matter of him delaying the inevitable. So this was his plan, slowly shifting in focus as his hope of success diminished. First, he focused on gathering information about what was going on and fought to keep control of valuable defences like Osgiliath. When the possibility came up to get the ring, he sent his best man to get it. Not that he would have immediately used it, just as a matter of last resort. That was the plan anyway. I suspect the ring would have tempted him sooner. Seeing Sauron's forces massing for attack once more, he called on Rohan and the southern fiefs to support him. He did not abandon Caer Andros or the Anduin, but the forces he allocated to each were limited and probably not up to the task, and he seemed to know that. Faced with what he thought were impossible odds, he hid behind Minas Tirith's strong walls, and when Faramir fell, he broke. There was no plan now, other than a merciful death. As he says, "Better to burn sooner than late, for burn we must. Go back to your bonfire, and I go now to my pyre. No tomb for Denethor and Faramir, no long slow sleep of death embalmed. We will burn like heathen kings before ever a ship sailed hither from the west. The west has failed. Go back and burn." The irony, of course, is that one of the final straws was seeing through the Palantir the black sails of the Corsairs of Umbar sailing up the Anduin. He thought it was them, but it was Aragorn. Aragorn brought with him reinforcements from the fiefdoms of the south, and at the same time arrived his ally Theoden with the Rohirrim. His calls for help were actually answered. There was hope where he saw none. The deeper tragedy is that in another time Denethor could have been a good ruler, wise, far-sighted and listening to counsel. We often give Denethor very short shrift, rightly for what he did and didn't do, but let's give him some small credit as well. He saw the scale of the challenge and in calling the banners and on Rohan, his plan did actually win the battle. Denethor is far from a hero, but is also, I personally feel, more of a figure to be pitied than reviled. A great man broken by tragedy. How big are the armies in Middle-earth at the time of the War of the Ring? Let's take a look. We've mentioned a few times how Sauron's army far exceeded that of his enemies, but by how much? How big was the garrison at Minas Tirith? How many elves were there in defence of Lothlorien? How about the Riders of Rohan? These are all good questions, because in trying to come to exact figures, we're fighting against a few of Tolkien's instincts. First, this is all in-world reporting. As we'll get onto in a moment, Saruman's forces were counted out of Isengard by Merry, who is not exactly experienced in warfare, but we have to go with his estimate because that's the best we have. Second, some of these battles and armies are not a part of the main story. How many fighting dwarves emerged from Erebor to face the Easterlings? How many men of Dale versus how many Easterlings? The main plot is far to the south in Gondor and Mordor at that point, so we're given hints, but not exact army sizes. And third, Tolkien didn't really focus on battles and warfare in his stories. Yes, they were a necessary central part of his narrative, but never the focus. Perhaps it's because he experienced the horrors of a very horrific war himself and didn't want to go back there. Or perhaps he saw the story as more than the battles, so spent less time on them. Either way, most of the battles in his story are done and dusted in a few pages, rather than often several chapters in other comparable fantasy epics. Those caveats out of the way, what can we say about the sizes of the armies in the War of the Ring? Let's start with Saruman. Saruman had been secretly building an army for a while, but still he had one of the smallest forces in the war. His objective in attacking Rohan was to divide and conquer, hoping to keep Rohan's strength tied down through things like Grima's control over Theoden, and because he had been so secret, surprising his opposition by the strength he did have, focusing on battles he thought he could win rather than waiting for Rohan's forces to unite. A fight against the Rohirrim in an open field would have been a massacre. Merry's estimation of those forces is as follows. I saw the enemy go, endless lines of marching orcs, and troops of them mounted on great wolves, and there were battalions of men too. Many of them carried torches, and in the flare I could see their faces. Most of them were ordinary men, rather tall and dark-haired, and grim, but not particularly evil-looking. But there were some others that were horrible, man-high but with goblin faces, sallow, leering, squint-eyed. Of all sorts together, there must have been 10,000 at the very least, said Merry. They took an hour to pass out of the gates. The goblin-faced humans are very probably what we would call half-orcs. Treebeard is horrified by this idea, and Tolkien himself said that they were Saruman's wickedest deed, the interbreeding of orcs and men, producing both men-orcs, large and cunning, and orc-men, treacherous and vile. Leaving aside important moral judgments on Saruman's forces, Merry's count is probably roughly accurate. There will surely also have been some defenders left in Isengard, but it seems that this was a nominal force at best, who were no match for the Ents who descended on there a bit later. And Saruman clearly had a few more patrols and groups hunting for the ring. The one that captured Merry and Pippin was one of them, but surely there were more. That group were big enough that 100 or more attacked Boromir and captured the hobbits. Then they encountered another group, where dozens of goblins emerged from the trees, so we're probably talking 100 or a couple of hundred or so per warband. At the end of the story, there also seemed to be something like 150 or so ruffians who took over the Shire. So if Merry is right with his estimation of 10,000 marching out of Isengard, at the very least, plus the warbands, plus whoever stayed in Isengard, plus the ruffians, we're obviously talking more than 10,000, but probably still less than 15,000 total. I've seen some estimates a bit more than that, but 12 to 15,000 in total seems like a reasonable central estimation. And that total is made up of orcs, Uruk-hai, some on wolf or walk-back, half-orcs and Dunlendings. Some will have died in the two battles of the Fords of Isen and at the hands of Boromir et al., but still there seem to have been over 10,000 at the Battle of Helm's Deep. Saruman focused the main strength of his army there. Facing them, we have the forces of Rohan. It's clear that the forces that Saruman faces in each battle are just a fraction of the army that Rohan could field, but Saruman and Grima's machinations mean that Rohan is outnumbered at every turn, at least to start with. We're told that at the first Battle of the Fords of Isen, the Rohirrim had 11 mounted companies and one company of archers. which adds up to about 1,400 soldiers, plus some men from the Westfold and, arriving partway into the battle, some reinforcements from Edoras, numbering four more companies, so perhaps another 500 or so. All told, 1,500 or so soldiers, then battle was joined and obviously some were lost, then 500 more arrived. At the second battle of the Fords of Isen, Saruman seemingly fielded the bulk of his forces, so at least 10,000, against Rohan's maximum 2,000. The resultant rout is therefore understandable. The Battle of the Hornburg again starts with a clear majority for Saruman, the bulk of his 10,000 left against the 1,000 or so garrison of Helm's Deep under the redoubtable Gambling, plus 1,000 more in reinforcements from Theoden. Later, Gandalf and Erkenbrand arrived with 1,000 more survivors from the battles of the Fords of Isen. Then there are the Huons. Tolkien never gives us an accurate count for the Ents and Huons, but there are clearly enough to eliminate the defenders of Orthanc and take out the retreating orcs at the Battle of the Hornburg. Your guess is as good as mine on that, but a forest full? And after all that, Theoden, once more in control of all his forces, but after many had been lost in battle, decides how many he can spare to help Gondor. This is what he thinks. 10,000 spears I might have sent riding over the plain, to the dismay of your foes. It will be less now, I fear, for I will not leave my strongholds all unguarded. Yet 6,000s at the least shall ride behind me. At the height of its powers, Rohan could field even more. Scholars suggest perhaps 12,000 knights. But after fighting various battles outnumbered and outmanoeuvred in different parts of their country, and knowing that other attacks were possible, 6,000 was what they could spare. At which point, let's head north. Several battles take place off-camera, as it were, in The Lord of the Rings, while our main characters are engaged in sneaking into Mordor or defending Gondor. As such, we have a lot less information about troop numbers and even the shape of the battles. One battle, taking place over 3 days, is between the Easterlings under Sauron's rule and a combined force of dwarves from the Lonely Mountain and men of Dale. Several decades earlier, in the Battle of the Five Armies, Dain's forces from the Iron Hills were just more than 500 strong. We know that Erebor grew in strength since then, but surely even with immigration and the rather slow dwarf birth rate, they couldn't field more than the low thousands. Similarly, the Lakemen in that earlier battle numbered only 200 or 300. Surely they couldn't have grown more in those few decades than to another few thousand. All told, the army of those two allies must have been a few thousand at most. And given that they were pushed back and forced into a siege in Erebor until news broke of events further south, we can probably assume that the invading Easterlings had a larger army to start with, though not overwhelming. Maybe 5,000 to 10,000, but that's just a guess. Mirkwood and Lothlorien were also attacked, though this time by orcs from Dol Guldur, supplemented by some orcs from Moria. The Mirkwood forces are probably easiest to estimate. Thranduil took 1,000 archers and 1,000 spearmen to the Battle of the Five Armies. Assuming a relatively stable elf population since then, and adding some because presumably the Elven King didn't take all of his forces to Erebor back in the day, I'll guess at 3,000 Mirkwood soldiers, being a mix of archers and spearmen. The host of Lothlorien is harder to estimate, though. It's a relatively small area and seemingly quite sparsely populated. They successfully defended themselves against 3 attacks during the War of the Ring, but I'd expect Galadriel's magic had quite a large part to play there. So your guess is again as good as mine. Probably smaller than Thranduil's army, so 1,000? They didn't really get involved in the action, but I think we can assume that Elrond at Rivendell would have been able to call on even fewer than that. The orcs of Dol Guldur attacked both Lothlorien and Mirkwood several times, including both at one time, losing pretty much every time, but still managing to come back until their final defeat. They therefore probably initially outnumbered the elves, but not overwhelmingly so. Let's put this one at, I don't know, 10,000, or perhaps as high as 20,000, given the defender advantages. Again, Tolkien gives us few clues here, so it's just an educated guess. Feel free to disagree in the comments below. I'd be fascinated to know what you think. By way of a summary in the Northern Theatre, Sauron's forces seemingly outnumbered the Free Peoples by a few thousand, enough to prevent those forces supporting Gondor and Rohan and weakening them for future attacks, but not enough to actually defeat them. And with that, let's return to Minas Tirith, because that's where we have the most detailed descriptions from Tolkien on force sizes, as the defenders of the city count their allies in as they arrive. Karen Wynne Fonstad in The Atlas of Middle-earth gives us a very good rundown of these forces, and Christopher Tolkien, who read the book, didn't disabuse her of her notion, so let's go what she said as a reasonable estimate. First, Denethor's garrison at Minas Tirith itself was around 2,000 strong. It had probably been larger, but the Battle of Osgiliath a few months earlier had been costly, and he had some forces set aside to defend Cair Andros and go with Faramir to defend the river and Osgiliath immediately before battle was joined. Denethor also called in the Banners, and around 1,100 arrived from the southern fiefs, a mixture of bowmen, hillmen, fisherfolk and the like, plus an estimated 1,200 from Dol Amroth. That's 700 plus a company on horseback. So that's 4 to 4,500 there defending Minas Tirith when Sauron's forces first attack. You can add to that 6,000 Rohirrim and perhaps 1,000 more from the southern fiefs and a handful of Grey Company that Aragorn brought from the south partway through the battle. So 11,000 or thereabouts in total defenders. Facing that, the Witch King's army was an army of such size had never issued from that vale since the days of Isildur's might. That's over 3,000 years. We're told of 18,000 Haradrim, plus their war olifants, plus Easterlings and Orcs. Tolkien also reveals in Unfinished Tales that more than half of Sauron's forces, presumably not including those held in reserve in Mordor that we find out about later, were involved in this battle. Given that we estimated the northern forces as 10 to 20,000, that puts the Witch King's army at 30 or maybe 40,000. If it were much more than that, then the word-precise professor would surely have talked about the majority of Sauron's forces being at Minas Tirith, or almost all of them. Unless, of course, you think there could have been more in Dol Guldur, you could go round in circles on this very easily. Any which way you look at it, the Free Peoples were vastly outnumbered at the Pelennor Fields, and only won because of, well, we'll look at that in the next video. When it comes to the Battle of the Morannon outside the Black Gate, we do have some reasonably precise numbers from Tolkien. Aragorn and the Army of the West set out with 7,000 soldiers, although en route Aragorn released 1,000 of those to guard their rear and to liberate Cair Andros, so 6,000 remained. In opposition to them, we're told that Sauron had 10 times and more than 10 times that number, so more than 60,000 that had until then been held in reserve, although some had probably retreated back from the Pelennor Fields to Mordor. So although these forces were spread unequally around Middle-earth, and Tolkien is deliberately vague on details, we can be pretty sure that Sauron's army overall numbered well in excess of 100,000, and probably significantly more. Saruman could field something over 10,000, and the Free Peoples all combined something between those two numbers, and probably closer to Saruman's total than Sauron's. And again, these are estimates, intended to give us a feel for the balance of power, not an exact science. Even without knowing exact numbers, we can say that Saruman had a big army, capable of taking on an individual kingdom like Rohan once he had weakened it, but not big enough to challenge the Free Peoples when they worked together. The Free Peoples could defend themselves for a time against Sauron with home advantage, but would have been swept away by Sauron's forces in an open field. Without reinforcements arriving from Rohan and the south, Minas Tirith would have fallen. If Sauron had concentrated more of his army on Dale and Erebor, he could probably have won there and had a free run at Mirkwood and Lothlorien. And Aragorn's force, marching on Mordor, was laughably outnumbered. They would have all died but for the ring being destroyed. These considerations, and of course what happened to the ring, were what drove the action in the War of the Ring, not just numbers of troops. We very often want to break things down to such a granular level that we lose sight of this big picture, that Sauron's forces far outnumbered that of the Free Peoples, or the story at a more personal level. Gimli and Legolas were each worth more than 40 orcs at Helm's Deep. And what about the impact of Gandalf, or the Witch King, or Grond, or Frodo and Sam? The War of the Ring is not just a matter of comparing army sizes. It's about continent-spanning strategy and individual heroism. What happened in the Battle of the Pelennor Fields, that epic battle outside Minas Tirith towards the end of the Return of the King? How close were Sauron's forces to taking the city? And how important was it in the context of the overall war? Last time, we took a quick pause to look at the relative army sizes we see in the war. Now we'll return to what was probably the largest battle in that war, the Battle of the Pelennor Fields. First, let's set the scene. Denethor has been waiting a long time for Sauron to finally strike towards Minas Tirith and has called in his allies. The Red Arrow has been sent to Rohan, and the southern fiefs have been ordered to send all they can spare to aid in the defence of the capital. And on the 10th of March, Sauron finally sends forth his army. They are overshadowed, literally, by dark fumes and clouds emanating from Mordor, covering the sun and allowing the army to move out. It becomes known as the Dawnless Day. The defenders in Minas Tirith knew then that battle would be with them within days. It sent a sense of dread ahead of it. The Witch King led Sauron's forces into this battle from atop his fell beast, alongside the other 8 Nazgûl. What prompted this move? Well, this is 6 days after the Battle of the Hornburg, and 4 after Aragorn stared into the Orthanc stone, telling Sauron he was the heir of Isildur, showing him the sword reforged and leaving him convinced that Aragorn had the One Ring. If Sauron wanted to retain the initiative, he had to move now, otherwise Aragorn might rally Gondor to himself and the Rohirrim join his side. To try to prevent that, a force of orcs was sent out to take Caer Andros, the fortified island in the Anduin River, and then pushed on to guard the main road from Rohan to Minas Tirith. Sauron had probably hoped that Saruman would have stopped the threat from Rohan, but now this was his best hope, to slow down any help they may send to Gondor while he threw his main force at Minas Tirith. At the same time, his allies, the Corsairs of Umber, started raiding along the Gondorian coastline, along with some Haradrim. This meant that when Denethor called the banners, the response he got from the southern fiefs was underwhelming at best. They were literally fighting for their lives at that point and couldn't spare many, if anyone, to help out Minas Tirith. All told, it was quite a sensible plan. Stop Minas Tirith's allies from helping while focusing the bulk of your troops on the city itself. We're not told the exact size of the Witch King's army marching on Minas Tirith, but it definitely included 18,000 Haradrim, along with their Mumakil, the 9 ring wraiths on their fell beasts, orcs and easterlings in their thousands, trolls and other beasts. It was the largest army to leave Mordor since the last alliance of elves and men, 3,000 years earlier. The first obstacle this army faced was the River Anduin and the ruined city of Osgiliath. You'll remember that at the very start of the war, Boromir, Faramir and others prevented an incursion by Sauron's forces by destroying the last bridge over the river. And now Denethor, fresh from learning of Boromir's death and Faramir's decision to let Frodo and the Ring go, sent Faramir back to Osgiliath to try to defend it. It was a mission bound to fail, and everyone knew it. The Witch King's army was just too big for the few defenders to deal with. The Gondorians did manage to inflict some casualties, but it soon transpired that the enemy had been secretly building boats on the east shore of the river for this very moment, so they could swarm across en masse rather than just a few at a time. Faramir retreated first to the Causeway Forts just outside Osgiliath, and then he was forced to lead a headlong retreat of about 12 miles back to Minas Tirith, that's nearly 20 kilometres. They were overtaken by Haradrim cavalry and would probably have all fallen, but for Prince Imrahil leading a cavalry charge out of Minas Tirith. Still, Faramir was struck down by a poisoned dart and the Black Breath and would play no further part in the war. It would be easy to see that initial flurry of battle as just an ill-judged move by Denethor made out of spite, which it was, but it actually had quite important knock-on effects. First, seeing Faramir at death's door took all of the fight out of Denethor, allowing Gandalf, Imrahil, Aragorn and others to step into the breach. The siege of Minas Tirith might have turned out different had Denethor been giving the orders rather than focusing on funeral pyres. And although Faramir's sortie was far from a success, it did manage to slow down the enemy advance by a bit, a few hours or perhaps even a day compared to there being no opposition. The siege would have started earlier, and Théoden and Aragorn would have arrived perhaps after Minas Tirith fell. Faramir's sacrifice wasn't for nothing. Still, at the time, it looked like a clear, if small, victory for the forces of darkness. They crossed the Anduin and cleared the Ramas Ekor, the lengthy outer defensive wall that encircled the Pelennor Fields outside Minas Tirith, simply blasting holes through it and passing through. Incidentally, it was these sizeable holes in the wall that allowed the Rohirrim to ride into the Pelennor Fields so easily later in the battle. But with the city at their mercy, the Witch King's army paused for a moment and dug in outside the range of the defenders' catapults. This was the 14th of March. The defenders in the city mocked them for a bit. Why didn't they attack? It seems that the plan was to weaken and dispirit the Gondorians first. The Nazgul continuously swooped over the city on their fell beasts, and although Tolkien doesn't give us the specifics, it's clear that their presence cast a pallor of fear and gloom into the defenders. Then came the catapults, clearly with a longer range than those of the defenders, so they couldn't reply, casting fiery rocks and the heads of vanquished foes into the bottom level of the city, setting it aflame and causing some of the defenders to flee to higher ground. Then, as midnight approached, the Witch King signalled the start of the assault. Many of the attackers died crossing the open ground outside the city, but they kept coming, hauling siege weapons, and soon they reached the wall and explosions were heard as they tried to break it down. Remember that Saruman's forces had used seemingly similar explosives in trying to take the Hornburg. Most effective of all was Grond, the spell-wrought mighty battering ram that took just 3 blows with the aid of the Witch King's fell magic to break down the gates. Minas Tirith had been breached. And all this was happening very quickly. The great gate and the walls had stood for centuries and many thought them unbreachable, but now in just a few short hours they were in ruins. The lower level of the city was aflame, its defenders fleeing in fear. The Witch King himself rode through the gate with a mocking laugh. This was the darkest moment. Just one person stood in the Witch King's way. We read this. There, waiting, silent and still in the space before the gate, sat Gandalf upon Shadowfax. Shadowfax, who alone among the free horses of the earth endured the terror, unmoving, steadfast as a graven image in Rath Dainan. "You cannot enter here," said Gandalf, and the huge shadow halted. "Go back to the abyss prepared for you. Go back. Fall into the nothingness that awaits you and your master. Go." The Black Rider flung back his hood, and behold, he had a kingly crown, and yet upon no head visible was it set. The red fires shone between it and the mantled shoulders, vast and dark. From a mouth unseen there came a deadly laugh. "Old fool," he said, "old fool, this is my hour. Do you not know death when you see it? Die now, and curse in vain." And with that he lifted high his sword, and flames ran down the blade. Gandalf did not move. And in that very moment, away behind in some courtyard of the city, a cock crowed. Shrill and clear he crowed, recking nothing of wizardry or war, welcoming only the morning that in the sky far above the shadows of death was coming with the dawn. And as if in answer, there came from far away another note. Horns, horns, horns. In dark Mindaluin's sides they dimly echoed. Great horns of the north, wildly blowing. Rohan had come at last. This was the turning point in the battle. All had seemed dark and lost, and now suddenly the dawn was here and help had arrived. The Witch King immediately turns his attention to the battlefield outside. Minas Tirith could wait. At which point, we should probably pause for a moment and explain how the Rohirrim happened to be there with no warning, because the Witch King will have known that with Saruman defeated, Theoden was now free to go to the aid of his Gondorian allies. Surely if the Rohirrim had been down that only road from Rohan to Minas Tirith, he would have got word of it from that force of orcs that had been placed there before the battle. Well, yes, he would have done if Theoden had taken that road, but he didn't. He went through the Druadan forest instead, a forest usually avoided by the Rohirrim and Gondorians, as they believed it to be haunted. But this time they were shown through the secret ways of the forest by the Woses, the people who lived there, and had long been persecuted and hunted by the outside world. Theoden promised, and Aragorn later delivered, independence and protection for that people going forward. In terms of this battle, it meant that the Rohirrim arrived on time, didn't have to face orcs en route, and their arrival surprised the Witch King, who hadn't expected them. The Rohirrim's first charge did immense damage to the Haradrim cavalry, clearing the northern part of the battlefield of the enemy. The Haradrim rallied, though. They still far outnumbered the 6,000 Rohirrim, and now the Witch King, back on his fell beast, was flying low and dispiriting the riders of Rohan with his fell presence. He then decided to take out King Theoden himself, landing on the battlefield. Theoden's horse reared and fell on him. It was a mortal wound. But Durnhelm, secretly Eowyn, stood over his body, and Merry snuck up behind the Witch King, and we know what happened there. If you're unsure of the exact mechanics of what happened, I did a whole other video on it, if you're interested. The Witch King was dead. Theoden mortally wounded, and Eowyn and Merry afflicted by the Black Breath. Gothmog, the lieutenant of Minas Morgul, took charge of the Witch King's army. Éomer, enraged at his father's death, led the Rohirrim in a mad charge at the enemy forces. This was undoubtedly heroic and effective in the short term, but perhaps not the most sensible tactic in that battle. Sauron's forces still had a huge numerical advantage, and those Mumakil were starting to have an effect. Even well-trained horses were panicked, and Gothmog, who, to be fair to him, seems to have reacted quickly and competently to his new command, ordered his troops to surround the Rohirrim, cutting them off from any help from Minas Tirith. Not that most of the troops in Minas Tirith were in any shape to help anyway, with one exception we'll come onto in a moment. This was when Denethor was getting all funeral pyre fixated, and Gandalf had to ride all through the city just to intervene and save Faramir's life while the bottom tier of the city was still in flames. This is the second dark point of the battle. We sometimes like to imagine the arrival of the Rohirrim as being the turning point, which it was for a while, but Sauron's numerical superiority was so huge that once the impact of that initial cavalry charge had been dealt with, and the riders were caught up in the hack and thrust of hand-to-hand combat with Mumakil running amok, things swiftly turned bad once more. Éomer and his surviving forces were surrounded and took to defending a hill. They saw the black sails of the Corsairs of Umber sailing up the Anduin and naturally assumed that this was yet more reinforcements for the enemy. At this point, Éomer even grimly starts to contemplate going down in history as Rohan's last leader, a title he held for brief hours since his uncle's death, and decides that his would be a heroic death. Of course, this was when the battle turned decisively, this time in favour of the Free Peoples. I mentioned that there was someone in Minas Tirith who was able to come to Éomer's aid. That was Prince Imrahil and his cavalry from Dol Amroth. Imrahil isn't often given the credit he deserves for his role in this battle, but he repeatedly acts bravely and brilliantly. And of course, those ships coming up the Anduin weren't the Corsairs, they were Aragorn, Legolas and Gimli with the Grey Company and as many recruits from the southern fiefs as he could bring. Not the dead men of Dunharrow, who in the films emerged in this battle, but in the books were released by Aragorn after they had seen off the Corsairs. Aragorn's force immediately charged to help Éomer on that hill, and it is suddenly Sauron's army that finds itself caught between enemies, with Imrahil's cavalry also joining the fray. Without the leadership of the Witch King, many of the orcs began to flee, leaving the Westerlings and Haradrim to fight to the death. But the battle was soon over, with the remains of Sauron's forces routed and heading back east. We don't know how many died in that battle, though it was a lot, or as Tolkien more poetically puts it, no few had fallen, renowned or nameless, captain or soldier, for it was a great battle, and the full count of it no tale has told. We do know that perhaps a third of the Rohirrim were slain in battle, and a great number of the men of Gondor too. Theoden died, as did many commanders and much of the Grey Company of Rangers. Denethor took his own life, Faramir, Eowyn and Merry were badly injured, and Minas Tirith itself was damaged seriously. On the other side, the Witch King was gone, as well as the Mumakil and large numbers of orcs and men. But Sauron probably didn't care that much. As huge as that army had been, he had an even larger force in reserve. Still, this was an unexpected reversal for Sauron. So, what went wrong with Sauron's plan here? He had actually set it up pretty well. The initial plan to rush the Anduin on pre-prepared boats, swamping any opposition, worked perfectly. Setting up his forces out of range of Minas Tirith's artillery, while softening up the defences with his own longer-range catapults and the powers of despair from the Nazgul, also worked really well. Grond was a spectacular success, breaking down the mighty city gates in no time. And even when the Rohirrim unexpectedly arrived and the Witch King even more unexpectedly died, the new commander rallied the troops, encircled the riders of Rohan, and would surely have defeated them soon, allowing the still large force to go back to attacking a depleted Minas Tirith. When you think of it, what actually made the difference in the end was Sauron and the Witch King's old evils coming back to haunt them. The Woses led the Rohirrim through their forest, enabling them to avoid the orcs and reach Minas Tirith in time, because the forces of evil and ignorance had oppressed them for so long. Aragorn could bring reinforcements from the Southern Fiefs because of the aid of the dead men of Dun Harrow, finally fulfilling their oath to support Isildur against Sauron. And Merry's sword, which was able to damage the Witch King so greatly, was only made all those centuries ago to defend against the endless attacks of the Witch King. The battle was won by the consequences of centuries of oppression and malevolent action, and the heroism of outnumbered free peoples on the field of battle. Still, the Battle of the Pelennor Fields will have felt like a Pyrrhic victory for the free peoples. It averted an even greater catastrophe, rather than put them into a strong position for the rest of the war. They now had some big decisions to make about what to do next. Put bluntly, they couldn't afford another victory this costly, whereas Sauron could. Sauron attempted to invade Lothlorien, Mirkwood, and the Lonely Mountain in The Lord of the Rings, but we hardly hear anything about it. So, what happened? Last time, we looked at probably the largest battle in the war, the Battle of the Pelennor Fields. Tolkien focuses a lot on that battle for obvious reasons, but while that was happening, other battles were going on in other places in Middle-earth that we care about. In fact, there were at least 7 major battles that took place off-camera in Lothlorien, Mirkwood, the Lonely Mountain, and Rohan that we hear almost nothing about. So let's right that wrong now and explain what happened. But first, the context. Sauron had been holding his forces back for a while, just one exploratory skirmish in Osgiliath, then focusing in on the Ring, sending out the Nazgul to lead the hunt. The outcome of that was that Sauron knew that the Ring was abroad, in Rivendell, and now the Wise would decide what to do with it. Then, on the 6th of March, 3019, Aragorn showed himself to Sauron through the Orthanc Stone. He convinced Sauron that he was coming for him, and Sauron assumed that he had the Ring. So Sauron, always wanting to be on the front foot, acted swiftly. 4 days later, on the 10th of March, which became known as the Dawnless Day, he launched his forces against Minas Tirith. He also, probably a bit earlier, sent out a force to take Cair Andros and push on into Rohan, and instructed his allies, the Corsairs of Umber, to harry and raid the coast of Gondor, so Minas Tirith's friends, fiefs and allies couldn't help in the defence of the city. Of course, Minas Tirith had more allies than just Rohan and its southern fiefs. Sauron needed to make sure that they didn't come south to help either. So the plan seems to have been to send armies there too. Not so much as to win new ground, but to keep everyone occupied. If Thranduil was focused on defending his kingdom, he couldn't send any elves south to aid Denethor, for example. Whether or not you think Thranduil or Dain or Galadriel or whoever would want to do that isn't the point. Sauron didn't want any elves or dwarves helping out in the south. Legolas and Gimli were enough. Thankfully for him, Sauron didn't need to march troops all the way up from Mordor to do that. He had a sizeable garrison at Dol Guldur in southern Mirkwood, and allies in Rûn. So he started with what he thought was probably his greatest potential foe, Lothlorien. Or Galadriel, to be more precise. He had been long aware of her, as Galadriel herself recognises when she talks to Frodo. I say to you, Frodo, that even as I speak to you, I perceive the Dark Lord, and know his mind, or all of his mind that concerns the elves, and he gropes ever to see me and my thought. But still, the door is closed. Sauron gropes ever to see her, probably because he strongly suspects that she has one of the 3 rings of power that Celebrimbor forged alone in the Second Age. He still eagerly wanted those rings, and recognised that they were very powerful tools in the right hands. Indeed, Galadriel makes it clear to Frodo that it is through the power of her ring that she shields and protects her people in Lothlorien. Tolkien's famously soft magic system doesn't go into details about exactly how that works and how it interacts with elves fighting against attacking forces of evil, but in the appendices to The Lord of the Rings, Tolkien summarised it as, "Three times Lórien had been assailed from Dol Guldur, but besides the valour of the elven people of that land, the power that dwelt there was too great for any to overcome, unless Sauron had come there himself." So the attacks on Lothlórien were probably doomed to fail because of the power of Galadriel's ring, unless Sauron himself turned up. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. As I said earlier, this doesn't seem to have been an invasion attempt by Sauron so much as a tactic to keep the elves and dwarves out of the war in the south. The first attack came on the 11th of March. That's the day after the Dawnless Day, when the Witch King's army marched out of Mordor towards Minas Tirith. The main bulk of the attacking force each time came from Dol Guldur, though seemingly with some support from the Orcs of Moria. The trees around the edges of Lothlórien suffered much fire damage, but this first battle was a convincing win for the elves. Some Orcs, retreating from that battle, then reformed to head further south into eastern Rohan, the Wold. We don't know exact force sizes, but again this doesn't seem to have been a serious invasion attempt, so much as an attempt to stop the Rohirrim from coming to Gondor's aid. They had just resisted one attack from Saruman, and now they had another incursion to worry about. Sure enough, word does reach the riders while they are already en route to Gondor. We read this. As they rode, rumour came of war in the north. Lone men riding wild brought word of foes assailing their east borders, of orc hosts marching in the Wold of Rohan. "Ride on, ride on," cried Éomer. "Too late now to turn aside. The fens of Entwash must guard our flank. Haste now we need. Ride on." This was a wise decision, as it turns out, though it must have seemed like a huge gamble at the time. How many orcs were there? How many Rohirrim lives would be lost while they rode to aid an ally? The day was saved, though, by Treebeard, with his Ents and Huons. He says later that, and I've edited this down quite a bit as I'm rather more hasty in speech than Treebeard, "To be sure, the Ents have played their part. There was a great inrush of those vermin of orcs, and they came over the river and down from the north, and these same foul creatures were more than surprised to meet us out on the wold, for they had not heard of us before, though that might be said also of better folk. And not many will remember us, for not many escaped us alive, and the river had most of those. But it was well for you, for if they had not met us, then the king of the grassland would not have ridden far, and if he had, there would have been no home to return to." So the Ents defended Rohan again, unasked for. Many orcs were pushed into the rushing river, more were killed by the Ents, and some escaped, presumably back to Dol Guldur. Treebeard isn't one for bragging, so I think we can accept his account that, but for his intervention, Théoden's forces would have been waylaid, or much of Rohan laid waste in his absence. 2 days after that, the Battle of Dale began. You may remember that a couple of years earlier, Sauron had sent an emissary to Erebor seeking news of the One Ring. He left without any news, and leaving some thinly veiled threats. We don't often talk about the lands to the east of Erebor, but they were largely under the thrall of Sauron, and they had been long threatening the burgeoning kingdom under the mountain and their human allies in Dale. The appendices pick up the story. At the same time as the great armies besieged Minas Tirith, a host of the allies of Sauron that had long threatened the borders of King Brand crossed the River Carnon, and Brand was driven back to Dale. There he had the aid of the dwarves of Erebor, and there was a great battle at the mountain's feet. It lasted 3 days, but in the end both King Brand and King Dain Ironfoot were slain, and the Easterlings had the victory. But they could not take the gate, and many, both dwarves and men, took refuge in Erebor, and there withstood a siege. When news came of the great victories in the south, then Sauron's northern army was filled with dismay, and the besieged came forth and routed them, and the remnant fled into the east and troubled Dale no more. So this was an initial victory for Sauron's forces. The kings of men and dwarves were both killed, and the survivors were forced back into the Lonely Mountain to prepare for a siege. The besiegers were only vanquished when word came from the south of Sauron's demise. Not that we should diminish this victory in any way. Gandalf name-checks it a few times, noting the valour of the dwarves and how important it was that they managed to hold firm. Sauron might have done great evil in the north if King Dain and King Bran had not stood in his path. The thinking seems to have been that had Sauron been able to neutralise the dwarves and men in Dale and Erebor, he could have joined his army of Eastlings to his Dol Guldur army and sweep across the north. You can easily see how you could do a pincer attack on Thranduil's forces in northern Mirkwood from Dol Guldur and Erebor. But the dwarves and men held firm, despite heavy losses. Sure enough, while that battle was going on, Sauron's forces in Dol Guldur had regrouped after their initial losses in Lothlorien and Rohan, and once more attacked in two directions this time. The second assault on Lothlorien went pretty much how the first one had, not successfully. But the battle under the trees in Mirkwood was harder fought. Huge swathes of the forest were burned, and surely many elves were lost, but the elves of northern Mirkwood prevailed, and the orcs retreated once more to Dol Guldur. Incidentally, if you are thinking to yourself right now that Sauron's forces were taking a lot of defeats, and yet still seemed to be throwing themselves into battle against superior opposition, some of which they seem to have little to no chance of defeating, the answer is yes, that's pretty much what was happening. But I think there's another layer here to Sauron's tactics that is often overlooked. Yes, he's trying to keep the elves and dwarves occupied so they can't help Gondor, and no, he doesn't really hold his troops' lives in much regard at all, so is happy to throw them into losing battles if it suits him. But even more to the point, Sauron was playing a long game. The number of elves in Middle-earth was finite and dwindling. Elves don't have many children, and through the Third Age they had been slowly emigrating west anyway. If he lost 1,000 orcs, he could replace them in a matter of a few years, but if they killed 100 elves, those elves would not be replaced. He could keep this going for decades if he wanted to. Remember, this is the guy who spent 3 centuries in disguise forging rings of power, just so he could sneak off and spend a few more decades forging another ring of power. Sauron was nothing if not patient. He didn't have to defeat the elves now, he could keep this going for centuries. But back to this war. Away to the south, the Battle of the Pelennor Fields had now been fought, and the assorted generals, kings, princes, and a wizard had decided to march on Mordor. We'll talk about that in the next video. Sauron's forces in Dol Guldur then launched a third and final assault on Lothlorien. Again, they failed. Although attacking 3 times does show how important Sauron thought it was, certainly more of a threat than Thranduil's elves. But then, on the 25th of March, came the end of the war in the south. Sauron and the Black Gate had fallen, the ring was destroyed, and with that, the power of Galadriel's ring also died. Still, the balance of power had shifted. Over in Dale, the Easterlings were routed by the dwarves and men, and Celeborn led a force of elves out of Lothlorien on the offensive, attacking Dol Guldur and moving northwards through Mirkwood, clearing out any evil they encountered. Thranduil led his forces south, and the 2 elven armies met halfway. Galadriel was involved too. We're told that she threw down Dol Guldur's walls and laid bare its pits, and the forest was cleansed. And that was that for the Northern Theatre. The orcs in Moria survived for a while longer, until Durin the Seventh retook it for Durin's folk. Mirkwood was no longer murky, so they renamed it the Wood of Green Leaves, with Thranduil retaining the northern part, Celeborn renaming the southern part East Lorien, and the middle bit went to the Beornings and the Woodmen. Though, of course, even that was a short-term thing in the grand scheme of things, with the elves largely sailing west. The war in the north is often overlooked in discussions about the War of the Ring. It shouldn't be. There was every bit as much valour and tragedy and death and heroism as there was elsewhere. Though, of course, all of these battles were just supporting acts in their own way to the real struggle which happened when they were raging. Frodo and Sam, slowly but purposefully, making their way to Mount Doom. The Battle of the Morannon, when Aragorn's army faced off against Sauron's outside the Black Gate, is the culmination of the War of the Ring. So we finally reach the last proper battle of the War of the Ring, and let's pick up the action in the wake of the Battle of the Pelennor Fields. Sauron's plan there had been to prevent Gondor's allies from aiding it while he attacked Minas Tirith. That sort of nearly worked, inasmuch as the elves of Lorien and Mirkwood and the dwarves of Erebor couldn't come to help if they wanted to. They were busy defending their own lands. Rohan and the southern fiefs provided some aid, but not as much as they might have without Sauron's work to hinder them too. Still, Minas Tirith survived the assault. Sauron's army were pushed back and suffered significant losses, not just in terms of troops, but the Mumakil seemed to have all been vanquished, Grond abandoned, and so on. But most notably of all was, of course, the loss of the Witch King. An immensely powerful figure in his own right, he was also the general of Sauron's army and his man in the field, if you like. Sauron didn't get out much, so he needed someone to act for him. But if anything, the losses on the side of the Free Peoples were even greater, despite their victory. King Théoden and Steward Denethor were dead. Faramir, Eowyn and Merry were grievously injured and would take no further part in the war. The Rohirrim had lost a third of their number, and Minas Tirith itself had its gates blown off and Lower Tir set afire. What were they to do? They had earned a brief respite, but Sauron would come again, and there was the matter of the Ring, of course. And so the generals and leaders assembled to discuss their options. This became known as the Last Debate. Gandalf was there, along with Aragorn and Elrond's two sons Eladan and Elrohir, Prince Imrahil and Éomer. And Gandalf started by acknowledging that Denethor had been right about one thing. The Free Peoples could not hope to prevail against Sauron's forces by strength of arms alone. They could regroup and refortify themselves, defending castle after castle, gaining victories here and there, but in the long run it would be to no avail. Sauron's forces were too strong. Which is a rather downbeat way to start a discussion about war plans. But he followed it up by saying that he did still hope for victory through the destruction of the One Ring. In particular, he knew Frodo was now in Mordor. He didn't think Sauron knew where the ring was, but suspected Aragorn had it after he showed himself through the Orthanc stone. So we read this. His, Sauron's, doubt will be growing, even as we speak here. His eye is now straining towards us, blind to almost all else that is moving. So we must keep it. Therein lies all our hope. This, then, is my counsel. We have not the ring. In wisdom or great folly, it has been sent away to be destroyed, lest it destroy us. Without it, we cannot by force defeat his force. But we must at all costs keep his eye from his true peril. We cannot achieve victory by arms, but by arms we can give the ring-bearer his only chance, frail though it be. As Aragorn has begun, so we must go on. We must push Sauron to his last throw. We must call out his hidden strength so that he shall empty his land. We must march out to meet him at once. We must make ourselves the bait, though his jaws should close on us. He will take that bait in hope and in greed, for he will think that in such rashness he sees the pride of the new ringlord. And he will say, so he pushes out his neck too soon and too far. Let him come on. And behold, I will have him in a trap from which he cannot escape. There I will crush him, and what he has taken in his insolence shall be mine again for ever. We must walk open-eyed into that trap, with courage, but small hope for ourselves. For, my lords, it may well prove that we ourselves shall perish utterly in a black battle far from these living lands, so that even if Barad-dûr be thrown down, we shall not live to see a new age. But this, I deem, is our duty, and better so than to perish nonetheless, as we surely shall if we sit here, and know as we die that no new age shall be. It's a plan. They are to march on Mordor, judging that Sauron will assume they have the ring, tempt his forces out to confront them, and hope that this frees the way for Frodo and Sam to make it safely to Mount Doom. They expect to die. The others swiftly sign up to the plan and agree that they need to move quickly. This isn't about actually having an army or tactics that could take on Mordor so much as distracting Sauron's attention. They judged that in 2 days' time they would have enough extra soldiers from the southern fiefs to defend Minas Tirith, and the victors of the Pelennor Fields would have time to briefly rest before setting out again. In total, they could muster 7,000 troops. They marched east out of the city on the 18th of March, crossing over the River Anduin, turning north at the crossroads. Aragorn left some archers there to protect his rear and proceeded along the border of Mordor through Ithilien. In keeping with their plan, there was no pretense of secrecy here. At Gandalf's prompting, they literally trumpeted Aragorn's presence as the King of Gondor. A couple of days into their march, there was an attempted ambush by some orcs and Easterlings, but that was relatively easily dealt with. Then, on the 23rd, Aragorn ordered all the faint-hearted, all those who didn't fancy marching to their almost certain death, to peel away from the main force and head west instead to liberate the fortified island of Cair Andros. Remember that? Sauron sent a force earlier to secure that northern crossing over the River Anduin and push on into Rohan to intercept the Rohirrim en route to Minas Tirith. Théoden avoided them by going through the Druidan forest, so the orcs were still there, loitering between Gondor and Rohan, and Cair Andros needed reclaiming. Around 1,000 volunteered to do that, leaving Aragorn with probably a bit under 6,000 to take to the Black Gate, which they reached on the 25th of March, after a last dark night encamped to the northwest of the Black Gate. At which point, let's do a quick bit of geographical scene setting. The Black Gate stood at the northwest corner of Mordor, completely spanning a gap or pass between two high cliffs. It was the only way in or out of Mordor, save Cirith Ungol, of course, for many miles. Behind it lay the Valley of Udun, and in front, two spurs of rock thrust out on either side of the gate, topped by strong fortifications, the Towers of the Teeth. Between the towers and stretching out northwest, Tolkien writes that there lay like a moat a great mire of reeking mud and foul-smelling pools. And beyond that, huge piles of refuse, mud, rock and earth left over from various building projects. In the absence of any better defensive position, Aragorn positioned his army on two of those slag hills, then rode forward into the mire of reeking mud with his honour guard. Basically the main named characters in the army, Gandalf, Éomer, Imrahil, Eladan, Elrohir, Legolas, Gimli and Pippin, to challenge Sauron. Through all this, Sauron's forces had remained quiet and largely hidden, though as Aragorn and his men approached they could see the 8 remaining Nazgul on their winged fell beasts hovering above the Towers of the Teeth, waiting. The battle was not quite yet to be joined, though. Aragorn's challenge prompted the arrival of the Mouth of Sauron. I've done a whole other video on who he is, if you're interested. His role here was ostensibly to treat with Aragorn on behalf of Sauron, but really it was to taunt Sauron's foes. Sauron will have seen what size force Aragorn had brought with him, and known that victory was all but assured. The Mouth of Sauron offered a deal that would never be accepted, ceding all land east of the Anduin to Sauron, and all land between that and the Misty Mountains are to be vassals. Aragorn and Gandalf between them sent him back on his way. Incidentally, the movie version of this scene has Aragorn beheading the Mouth of Sauron. That doesn't happen in the books. However detestable we may find him, the Mouth of Sauron is an ambassador with rights of free passage, and Gandalf explicitly guarantees his safety. Anyway, after he had gone, the Black Gate opened and Sauron's forces poured out, and not just from behind the Black Gate. An army of Easterlings had been stationed just out of sight to the east of the Black Gate, and orcs in caves and crevices on the hillsides themselves scrambled down. Aragorn swiftly solidified his defensive position. As Tolkien writes, little time was left to Aragorn for the ordering of his battle. Upon the one hill he stood with Gandalf, and there, fair and desperate, was raised the banner of the Tree and Stars. Upon the other hill, hard by, stood the banners of Rohan and Dol Amroth, White Horse and Silver Swan. And about each hill a ring was made, facing all ways, bristling with spear and sword. But in the front, towards Mordor, where the first bitter assault would come, there stood the Sons of Elrond on the left, with the Dúnedain about them, and on the right, the Prince Imrahil, with the men of Dol Amroth, tall and fair, and picked men of the Tower of Guard. The Free Peoples were essentially surrounded and vastly outnumbered. We don't have an exact count for Sauron's forces, but it was at least 60,000. The Boggy Mire gave the host of the West some protection. It slowed the orcs' advance so much that many of them stopped completely, drew bows and rained fire down on their enemies instead. A company of hill trolls wasn't so easily slowed down, though, and they slammed into the Free Peoples first. Overhead, the Nazgûl swooped over the battle, spreading fear and doubt. Note again the difference to the movie version here. There is no "for Frodo" or charge at the enemy lines by Aragorn across a dusty plain. This was not about victory for the Free Peoples, or even survival. It was about eating up as much time as possible while distracting Sauron's attention, so they would wait for Sauron to attack. And attack Sauron's army did. This was the dark moment when hope was slim. Tolkien skillfully cuts away from the action at this moment in the book, moving to Frodo and Sam for three whole chapters, because that's where the really important action is taking place. Where had they got to while that battle was going on? Would they get to Mount Doom and destroy the ring in time? Had Gandalf and Aragorn's gambit worked? We know the answers to that, but first-time readers wouldn't have, adding to the tension. In fact, we had last seen Frodo and Sam in the book at the end of the Two Towers, with Frodo captured in Cirith Ungol. What hope was there? But let's return to the battle, because for Tolkien, hope is often shown by the arrival of the Great Eagles, and they arrived now, taking on the Nazgûl in the skies over the battlefield. Still, Sauron's main forces had now reached Aragorn's and were cutting them down mercilessly. Suddenly, though, something shifted. The Nazgûl turned in the air, and as one flew back towards Mount Doom. Frodo had put on the One Ring, and they were racing to get back in time. With them gone, Sauron's army lost heart briefly. The fear and power that had driven them on was lifted and focused elsewhere, and Aragorn's forces pressed their sudden advantage. Bigger things were happening at the cracks of Doom. The Ring had now been destroyed. Gandalf lifted up his arms and called once more in a clear voice. "Stand, men of the West, stand and wait. This is the hour of doom." And even as he spoke, the earth rocked beneath their feet. Then, rising swiftly up, far above the towers of the Black Gate, high above the mountains, a vast soaring darkness sprang into the sky, flickering with light. The earth groaned and quaked. The towers of the teeth swayed, tottered, and fell down. The mighty rampart crumbled. The Black Gate was hurled in ruin. And from far away, now dim, now growing, now mounting to the clouds, there came a drumming rumble, a roar, a long echoing roll of ruinous noise. "The realm of Sauron is ended," said Gandalf. "The Ringbearer has fulfilled his quest." And as the captains gazed south to the land of Mordor, it seemed to them that, black against the pall of cloud, there rose a huge shape of shadow, impenetrable, lightning-crowned, filling all the sky. Enormous it reared above the world. It stretched out towards them a vast, threatening hand, terrible but impotent. For even as it leaned over them, a great wind took it, and it was all blown away and passed. And then a hush fell. The captains bowed their heads, and when they looked up again, behold, their enemies were flying, and the power of Mordor was scattering like dust in the wind. Orcs and other creatures of Sauron were broken and directionless. They fled or turned on one another, or threw themselves into dark crevices where they could find them. Some of the Easterlings and Haradrim held firm for a time, but soon many of them turned too. Sauron's dark rule was over. The ring had been destroyed. Fighting carried on for days, weeks, even years, rooting out all those still loyal to Sauron in Mordor, or in the battles of the North that we looked at last time. But the plan had worked perfectly, distracting Sauron and tempting him into emptying his forces out to face Aragorn at just the right time to open the way for Frodo and Sam. A victory, and a decisive one, but through humility, fortitude and pity, not force of arms. Of course, there is one more battle we should talk about before the end, in the Shire. A footnote in the grand scheme of things, but an important one. What actually happened in the scouring of the Shire? The Battle of Bywater is the last battle in the War of the Ring, so let's take a look. Last time, we looked at the Battle of the Morannon, which is generally considered the end of the War of the Ring. The Ring was destroyed and Sauron defeated. Of course, fighting carried on for a while afterward, clearing out the remnants of Sauron's forces. The Battle of Dale, or the Siege of Erebor, lasted a couple more days until the 27th of March, and the cleansing of Mirkwood wasn't complete until the 6th of April. Meanwhile, the story, of course, focuses on rewards and recognition, marriages and merriment, and friends' fond farewells, until the penultimate chapter when the hobbits arrive back in the Shire, only to find it overrun by ruffians. They lead the rebellion. It's an important plot moment showing how they have grown, literally as well as figuratively in Merry and Pippin's case, and can return the Shire to its bucolic idyll. The seeds of this were actually sown decades earlier. Saruman became inquisitive as to why Gandalf spent so much time in the Shire, so went to investigate that land in disguise several times. He started smoking pipeweed and enjoyed it, but as he had mocked Gandalf for that a few times, he kept that secret. He set up a little import business buying pipeweed from Lotho Sackville Baggins. That's why Merry and Pippin found some in the storehouse at Isengard. So Saruman's human lackeys were already used to going in and out of the Shire, and Lotho Sackville Baggins had even more money, which he used to buy not just Bag End from Frodo, but also the Old Mill. Once Frodo and co. were gone, he tightened his grip on the Shire, knocking down the Old Mill and replacing it with a more industrial version, closing the inns, imprisoning any opposition, claiming the title chief, and using human ruffians to enforce his rule. Basically, he set himself up as a dictator. But then Saruman came, adopting the name Sharky. Treebeard had released him from his house arrest in Orthanc, and he had headed up there as he already had links to the area and probably had heard about Lotho's coup. He took over and doubled down on the industrialisation and brutality. Before we get to the Four Hobbits' return, it's worth noting that there were some scuffles and small battles before that. The Tooks didn't allow the ruffians into Tookland, for example, leading to a few skirmishes with some casualties, but Tookland stood firm. That was Pippin's dad who led that particular resistance, by the way. In the winter, in Bree, Bill Ferny let some ruffians in, but they were repelled at the loss of 5 Breelanders. Bill and some ruffians headed off to the Shire, while others set themselves up as bandits. So that was the situation when the hobbits returned. There were perhaps 300 ruffians in the Shire at the time. When the ruffians heard that some travellers had returned with swords and armour, and no intention of backing down, they sent a squad of about 20 men to Bywater, where the hobbits were, to put down the opposition. But the hobbits had used their time wisely, rallying the local populace, around 200 of them, to grab whatever stick or sharp object they could and man the barricades, or hide in the shadows, actually. Farmer Cotton, that's Rosie Cotton's dad, stood alone in the centre of the road blocking the way, tempting them forward to arrest him. As the ruffians advanced, the hobbits emerged and surrounded them. They tried to make a break back down the road towards Hobbiton, but their leader was felled by 4 hobbit arrows, and the rest gave themselves up. It was a victory for the hobbits, but a bigger battle awaited the next morning. Sure enough, the ruffians had got their act together, and now a force of around 100 came marching up from Waymeet. Thankfully, by this time, Pippin had managed to gather another 100 armed hobbits from Tookland to join them, and the hobbits set up in a very similar way they had last time, though in an even better defensive position. Tolkien writes, "The ruffians came tramping along the east road, and without halting, turned up the Bywater Road, which ran for some way sloping up between high banks with low hedges on top. Round a bend, about a furlong from the main road, they met a stout barrier of old farm carts upturned. That halted them. At the same time, they became aware that the hedges on both sides, just above their heads, were all lined with hobbits. Behind them, other hobbits now pushed out some more wagons that had been hidden in a field, and so blocked the way back." The ruffians, as their name suggests, might have been deadly with a cudgel or a sword, but they weren't great military tacticians. That's twice they'd walked straight into a trap. Nor were they particularly disciplined. Merry told them to surrender, and a few of them did, though then those were set upon by some of the others. 20 or so tried to break back the way they had come, past the wagons. They were mostly shot or hunted down in the fields beyond. The remainder, perhaps 80 or so, tried to climb the banks or break through the barrier. Many of those were shot as they tried, but some made it and attacked the hobbits they found there. Merry and Pippin, who had been on the other side of the road, rushed to the rescue, with Merry killing their leader, and the last few ruffians were encircled by a ring of archers and were forced to surrender. All told, nearly 70 ruffians were killed, and a dozen more had been captured. The rest, we assume, escaped. 19 hobbits had died and 30 more injured, but the point was made. The ruffians had taken control by targeting hobbits in small groups and banning them from getting together in inns and the like, but now the hobbitry were united, and although there were probably still 200 more ruffians in the Shire, these soon vanished once they realised the game was up. It was to be the last battle of the war, and the last recorded battle ever fought in the Shire. A memorial was set up on the hillside commemorating all those who had lost their lives. All that was left was to confront Sharkey, who was, of course, Saruman, and he met his end not by the hobbits exacting revenge, but by Grima turning on him. We should probably leave the last words to the hobbits themselves after Saruman's demise. "And that's the end of that," said Sam. "A nasty end, and I wish I needn't have seen it, but it's a good riddance." "And the very last end of the war, I hope," said Merry. "I hope so," said Frodo, and sighed. "The very last stroke. But to think that it should fall here, at the very door of Bag End. Among all my hopes and fears, at least, I never expected that." "I shan't call it the end till we've cleared up the mess," said Sam gloomily, "and that'll take a lot of time and work." Of course, Sam did clear up all the mess and replant all the trees, and the Shire was returned to its beautiful best. Not the same as it had been before. It was changed and different, but it was saved, and the hobbits, like the rest of the Free Peoples, could return to the things in life that actually matter. Friends, family, song and laughter. And that, I suppose, is the point of all that warfare, or it should be. The cavalry charges and the heroism, as well as the sacrifices and destruction. It was because there is still some good in the world, like there is in our world. And it's worth fighting for. And that's it. I hope you enjoyed this compilation on the War of the Ring. Let me know in the comments below if you'd like to see more compilation videos like this. I'll see what I can do. In the meantime, if you'd like to watch more Lord of the Rings videos, there's a link to my playlist on the left of your screen. Or to support this channel, thank you. There's a link to my Patreon page on the right of your screen. Thanks for watching. That's all for this time. I'll see you again soon.